Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Jim Stein, a host on the New Books Network. Our guest today is Wade Rauch, the author of Extraterrestrials. This tremendously entertaining book examines one of the great questions confronting humanity. Are there extraterrestrial civilizations? And if so, why haven't we seen any evidence of it? It's a delightful and easy-to-read summation of the original Fermi question, where are they? And the history of how we've explored it and what conclusions we might come to based on those explorations. Wade, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a delight to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Wade, I was fascinated by the story you tell in the preface of how you initially became interested in extraterrestrials and how you came full circle to write this book. And I think our audience would enjoy hearing it, too.
Well, I'd be happy to tell it quickly. Sure. So I should say first up that I'm a kind of a child of the 70s and 80s when, of course, movies about aliens were, you know, every weekend there was a new movie about aliens, right? Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. If you go back a little bit before that, 1968's hit, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Of course, Star Wars and Star Trek. All of these fictional treatments had made it completely sort of a standard assumption in our culture that, well, of course there are aliens, and of course we'll meet them someday. So that was kind of the atmosphere I grew up in. And then along came Carl Sagan and his TV show Cosmos, which aired on PBS in 1980, when I was about 13 years old. And I would say that was the show that got me hooked on this question about extraterrestrials and first made me realize that it wasn't simply a question for science fiction or for mythology or literature, but it was a question that scientists could investigate. Fast forward about 5 years, I was 18 and going off to college, and I was lucky enough to be at Harvard College in September of 1985, when the college was dedicating a new computer programmed by a physicist at Harvard named Paul Horowitz. And this computer was specialized to sift through millions of radio frequencies very quickly for evidence of signals from intelligent civilizations. And it cost some money to build it. And Paul had gotten some grants from the Planetary Society, which was an advocacy group set up by Carl Sagan. And Steven Spielberg had also pitched in. So Spielberg and Sagan were both on campus to help celebrate this event. And I was there as a freshman journalist reporting for the campus newspaper. And I wound up covering the symposium, talking with Sagan and Horowitz. And that was my very first published story of any kind. And Well, that was what got me hooked on the whole subject of extraterrestrials and, in fact, also got me launched on a career as a science journalist. So in a way, although I never came back to the topic until I wrote this book, it's been bubbling there in the back in the background of my head for a very long time.
Fascinating. How did Enrico Fermi's classic question on extraterrestrials, where is everybody, arise?
Well, there's some debate about that. I mean, there's agreement on the basics. So Enrico Fermi was a genius Italian-born physicist who came to the U.S. before World War II, wound up working on the Los Alamos Manhattan Project, and then working on the hydrogen bomb project, also at Los Alamos after that. And everyone who recounts this story agrees on the basics, which was that Fermi Emil Konopinski, Edward Teller, and a couple of other physicists were sitting down at lunch at Los Alamos one day in 1950, and they got into a discussion about a cartoon that had appeared that week in The New Yorker. And this cartoon showed aliens getting off a flying saucer, presumably on their planet, and each alien was carting around a trash can marked New York Department of Sanitation. And the joke, which you had to kind of be a New Yorker to understand, was that there had been a rash of thefts of trash cans. Nobody understood why all the trash cans in New York were disappearing. And at the very same time, of course, this is the late 40s, 1950 or so. That was exactly the time when people were first reporting a rash of UFO sightings, and the idea of flying saucers had just kind of caught on. So the cartoon was sort of like a joking meshing of, or melding of those two memes into one. And the physicists were sitting around kind of joking about the cartoon. And this led to a conversation about extraterrestrials. And at some point, everyone agrees, Teller spoke up and said, "Don't you wonder where everybody is?" Or he might have said, "Where is everybody?" There's the exact wording people seem to disagree on. But it was understood that he was asking, if there are aliens at all, let's think for a minute about why we haven't seen any of them. There probably aren't such things as flying saucers. We can discount that. The idea that, you know, there are aliens visiting us in these flying saucers right now is probably a little bit ridiculous. But that does actually beg the question of why there aren't any aliens here, given that the galaxy is pretty old, and that if any single technological civilization developed interstellar travel, they really ought to have expanded across the galaxy and visited basically every habitable planet by now. But they haven't, as far as we know. So that became known as sort of the Fermi question. And over time, it kind of got refined into something called the Fermi paradox. By the late 70s, people were speaking about it as the Fermi paradox. And it just kind of boils down to the question of, if there's any life at all in the galaxy, why hasn't it developed to the point where we've been visited by other beings? Why is it that we seem to be alone, given everything we know about planetary formation and evolution and the chances that life will arise and our own history as a civilization? One would think that we would have some company and that they would have visited us, but it seems like they haven't. So how is that?
Well, what is SETI and what has it discovered?
Well, SETI, S-E-T-I, is an acronym that stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And what it has discovered, I would say, is evidence that there are no nearby civilizations trying to get our attention. It's a null result so far, but you can never prove a negative. So the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, as Carl Sagan and other folks would often say. So we can't conclude from SETI's null results so far that there are no other extraterrestrial, that there are no civilizations outside our solar system. All we can conclude so far, after about 50 years, 60 years really, of searching, is that there aren't any civilizations transmitting close enough to us that we can pick up their signal and understand their signal. That leaves a lot of room for other possibilities. It doesn't rule out the possibility that we have company in the galaxy. All it does say is that we don't have the technology or the right technique so far for finding them.
One of the things that arose at this in this era was the Drake equation. What is it and what can we conclude from it?
Yeah, great question, because the Drake equation has become sort of an organizing principle for a lot of discussions about extraterrestrials. And it dates back to a kind of milestone event in SETI, which is that in 1962, a group of astronomers and radio astronomers and physicists and other thinkers got together at Green Bank, West Virginia, which was the site of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And this meeting had been convened by Frank Drake, who was a young astronomer working at the observatory, and a sponsor from the National Science Foundation. And they just wanted to have a weekend of discussion about the science of aliens, basically. They wanted to start thinking more systematically about whether there might be extraterrestrials for us to find, because Frank Drake himself had, in fact, been doing that for a couple of years. He had come up with a thing called Project Ozma in 1960 and had spent some time on the telescope, one of the telescopes at Green Bank, searching for signals, and had come up dry. But there was increasing interest in this question. So all of these scientists assemble at Green Bank for this conference, and it's Frank Drake's job to come up with an agenda for the meeting. And the way he tells the story, he tried to think about all the different factors you would need to consider if you were trying to figure out how many other high-tech civilizations there might be in the galaxy, civilizations with enough technology that we would have a chance of communicating with them. And he realized that that question sort of depended on a number of different factors, like, well, how many stars are there in the galaxy? How many of those stars have planets? How many of those planets have life on them? And so forth. And then he wound up writing down these factors as sort of in a pseudo equation that became known as the Drake equation, that kind of lays out a possible path to high-tech civilization, one factor at a time. And I'd be happy to go through those, but that's the basic explanation, and it has persisted ever since because it's just such a useful way of thinking about the problem.
The idea of extraterrestrial civilization started a long time ago. What is plurality of worlds, and how did the idea arise and evolve?
Sure. Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. The idea that there might be extraterrestrials predates Frank Drake and the Green Bank meeting by millennia, really. I mean, if you think about it, Jim, I mean, I would make an argument that there's almost like a place in the human mythos, human brain, maybe. It might be baked into our psychology, into our thinking as a species, that we're not necessarily alone, that there might be other beings, that there might be higher forms of existence. And we've been reading those ideas into the heavens for probably tens or hundreds of thousands of years. But we certainly have been speculating more explicitly about whether there might be other worlds inhabited by other sentient beings since, you know, at least 500 or 600 BCE. And that idea was written down by Greek philosophers like Democritus and Epicurus and passed along over the years. And it eventually kind of settled into this idea that was, that became known as the plurality of worlds. And it's simply the idea that Earth may not be the only inhabited planet in the galaxy or in the universe, and that if you think more broadly about where life might arise and what the universe is made of, you know, if the Earth is made of atoms, if atoms are everywhere, then there might be other planets made of other atoms, and there might be other people on those other planets. That's the plurality of worlds ideas, and it went through many, many transformations and iterations over the centuries and over the millennia. But has kind of stuck with us and developed into what we now think of as a more systematic field of SETI or astrobiology.
Well, I know that Girolamo Bruno got burned at the stake for something like this in the early portion of the 17th century. But later on, it became a mainstream idea during the 17th and 18th century. How did that happen?
I think basically, it just took a while for the idea to gain circulation and to become respectable and to exit the realm of heresy. I mean, we're talking about the Renaissance and the early Enlightenment here, when a lot of ideas were, becoming safer to talk about, at least in an intellectual or philosophical way, so that it was no longer considered, you couldn't be burned at the stake by the year, say, 1750 or 1800 for just broaching the idea that there might be other worlds with other beings. So, the idea basically took hold post-Bruno in a form that you could have a respectable coffeehouse debate about it, right, in late 18th century France or someplace like that. And I think that by the early 19th century, it had certainly become part of an overall sort of scientific realist worldview that was widely shared by many Enlightenment thinkers.
Well, there's got to be a naysayer somewhere, and that was William Whewell. What weaknesses in the plurality of worlds theory did he point out?
Well, right. William Whewell was he was the master of Trinity College at Cambridge, which was the same college where Sir Isaac Newton had taught centuries before. And he was a highly respected scientist, but also a deeply devout Christian. And while he started out his career believing in, or at least leaving room for, the idea of extraterrestrials, he eventually kind of came to the conclusion that the idea that there might be other inhabited worlds was not compatible with strict Christianity. I mean, if you want to go into the details, it's basically a theological argument.
Not really necessary.
Well, if there can't be multiple saviors to save multiple worlds, then you kind of have to conclude that the Earth is the only inhabited world. That was the basic idea motivating Whewell. And because he had started thinking in this more skeptical way about the idea of the plurality of worlds, he actually did marshal quite a few quite rational and really penetrating questions and arguments for why we might, in fact, be alone. And those questions were things like, well, you know, it would be nice to believe that there are living beings on Jupiter, for example, but it doesn't look like Jupiter has a breathable atmosphere, and also the gravity would crush you. It doesn't look like Mars has enough water to support life. You know, he started asking more scientifically grounded questions about whether aliens might exist. And the important effect of all of that was to make people who were more open to the idea of science, the important outcome was to make people who were more open to the idea of extraterrestrials actually go and start looking for better evidence. So it was important, and it kind of pushed the whole debate forward.
And speaking of moving forward, we're now moving close to the 20th century. Who was Percival Lowell, and how does his theories of canals on Mars, which would obviously supply water, arise from a mistranslation, and how were they eventually overturned?
Percival Lowell was an aristocratic Bostonian who came from a prominent textile family. They had plenty of money, and he was wealthy enough to be able to go and build his own personal observatory in Arizona in the 1890s. And he had become infatuated with this idea spread by an Italian astronomer named Schiaparelli, that there were canals on Mars. Schiaparelli had published a couple of books alleging that he had observed lines or marks on the surface of Mars through his telescope. And in his books, he called them canali. And the legend was that when Schiaparelli's books got translated from Italian into English, translators took that word canali and translated it as canals. Another natural translation for that word would have been channels. And whereas a channel could be natural or artificial, a canal is almost by definition artificial. And that got, the idea is, the legend is, that mistranslation sparked Lowell's search for similar canals and motivated him to build his observatory. The truth, I think, is a little more complicated. I kind of dug around in Schiaparelli's writings, and I think it was clear even before Lowell came along that Schiaparelli thought that the canals might be artificial, and he certainly wasn't discouraging that kind of talk. So I don't think that the mistranslation story really holds water in the end, but it is one of those stories that journalists call too good to fact check.
In 1939, because I remember this because my parents told me about it, Orson Welles did a radio broadcast of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. What happened?
Well, yeah, that's a famous moment in American cultural history and media history. You can jump back to Percival Lowell, whose work inspired H.G. Wells to write The War of the Worlds, which came out in serial form, I think, in 1899 and 1900, and then came out as a novel. Fast forward about 39 years, and Orson Welles, part of the Mercury Radio Theater of the Air, decided to produce a live radio dramatization of the George of the H.G. Wells story, and that's what we now remember as sort of the Halloween night hoax, in a sense. But the newscast, the dramatization was sort of presented as if it were a newscast. It was sort of a faux, you know, an announcer breaking in and talking about how Martians had landed in New Jersey. And the myth, again, is that the story, the radio performance caused widespread panic. That in itself is open to question. How many people actually panicked? How many people really believed that there were Martians landing in New Jersey? That has been kind of a myth that's gradually been deflated over the years. But either way, it went down in cultural history as kind of a touchstone moment in the history of radio. And it was just, I would say it was yet another illustration of how deeply the idea of extraterrestrials had kind of gotten wedged into the human mind by that point, to where at least some people did take seriously, could take seriously the idea that, that Martians had landed in New Jersey. So I like to cite it because, you know, basically it's just evidence that the idea of extraterrestrials by that point was very deeply embedded and considered to be widely credible.
The search for extraterrestrial civilizations depends largely on radio astronomy. How did that start?
It's sort of a question of you search for the things you can search for. So you've probably heard the story about the drunkard searching for his keys under the light post, right? The cop comes along and says, "What are you searching for? My keys? And did you lose them here?" And the drunkard says, "No, but this is the only place where there's light." So that's a long way of saying the first scientists who got seriously interested in probing the Fermi paradox and starting to actually look for evidence of extraterrestrials happened to be physicists who were also steeped in astronomical thinking and who were familiar with radio astronomy and who happened to have access to radio telescopes. So they had a tool at hand that they could use to actually turn this field that had been philosophical and theoretical for centuries into something that was more empirical and evidence-based. So they did. And radio telescopes were the tools they had at hand, so they started using them to peer out at specific places in the sky to see if there was anyone trying to get in touch with us. To flesh that out just a little bit more, I mean, it's even more accidental in a sense in that it was only the result of some sort of serendipitous discoveries in the 1930s that we had realized that there were such thing as radio sources in the sky. A Bell telephone engineer named Jansky was trying to figure out why there was so much static interfering with transatlantic telephone radio conversations, and accidentally built a machine, built a telescope that wound up discovering some of the first sources of radio interference from the sky, which eventually, after World War II, led to the whole birth of the field of radio astronomy. And so by the late 50s, people were building telescopes large enough to actually start being able to ask, you know, could there be civilizations out there that are aiming radio signals at us? So it was kind of a long series of accidents. And in a sense, the whole field of SETI has been defined by the radio search for these potential signals. And it may, in fact, be timed for us to start thinking about how to grow beyond that, how to grow beyond the phase when we're only looking for radio signals or optical signals.
Yeah, you touch on that, well, more than touch on that in a later portion of your book. But about this time, something called the 21-centimeter hydrogen line became very prominent in the search. What is it and what role does it play?
The 21-centimeter hydrogen line is the characteristic frequency at which hydrogen atoms release radio waves. It gets into quantum mechanics, but the short version of the story is that every hydrogen atom has one proton and one electron, and usually the quantum spin of these two particles are the same. They're both sort of up or down. Once in a while, the spin of the electron can flip from up to down, and so you wind up with a transition from parallel spin to anti-parallel spin, and when that happens, a little bit of energy gets released. That energy is always released at a very specific frequency, 1421 megahertz or 21 centimeters. And it happens to be a frequency that carries very well through interstellar space. It doesn't get stopped by space dust. It doesn't get stopped by our atmosphere. So it's easy for us to see it. It's a very sharply defined line. And it became basically one of the first markers for radio astronomers of frequencies that would be equally referenceable by anyone, right? Because there's so much hydrogen in the universe. It's the most common element in the entire universe. And it emits at this very specific frequency when atoms go through this spin flip transition. So therefore, it would be known to every civilization as a kind of a reference frequency. And it became the starting place for almost every SETI search since 1960.
Well, you know, we talked about the Drake equation earlier, and what the Drake equation does is it gives you an estimate of the number of civilizations that have achieved a sufficient technology that we can communicate with them. How is the estimate of the number of such intelligent extraterrestrial civilizations changed over the years?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that the Drake equation has always been more of just a tool for discussion and argumentation, rather than a scientific question. It's everyone accepts that it's the kind of equation that is designed to lead to a range rather than a specific estimate. So basically, you can assign upper and lower bounds to a bunch of the terms in the equation, and depending on whether you're feeling optimistic or pessimistic, when you multiply all these terms, you wind up with either a very small number, or in some cases, a very large number. So N, which is the first, N is the kind of the culmination. The point of the Drake equation is N, which is supposed to represent the number of communicative technological civilizations in the galaxy. So the number of other civilizations we might have a chance of making contact with. And N can't be any less than one. Right? Because we're here. We really think we're here. We think we're here anyway. So N can't be any less than one. But there have been any number of estimates of what the upper bound of N might be. The Green Bank group that I talked about before, Frank Drake, Carl Sagan, these other guys who got together in Green Bank in 1962, they put the lower bound for N at 20, and they put the upper bound at 50 million. Now you can reach almost any number you want, just depending on what values you plug into the different factors. I've taught a couple groups of MIT undergraduates, and one of our exercises in class is to go through the Drake equation and come up with our own estimates. And our group has come up with an even broader range of estimates with a lower bound of 1 and an upper bound of 6 billion. So the point of the equation is not, again, to come to any sort of hard conclusions about how many other civilizations there are. It's really more to just give you a way to think about all of the different factors to consider when you're trying to add up the probability that we're not alone in the galaxy. So an estimate like 1 is probably pretty low and pretty pessimistic. An estimate like 6 billion is probably way too high. Because if there were 6 billion other civilizations in the galaxy, a lot of them would be so close that we would already have made contact. So there's some middle range that might be more realistic. We just, we can't be much more exact about what it is.
How did the search for extraterrestrial intelligence morph into the idea of sending a message to possible extraterrestrial intelligences? And what was the general feeling about whether or not the advisability of doing this?
Well, it turns out that the same instruments that you need to listen for radio signals from other star systems are also very good at transmitting signals. So, for example, the Arecibo radio telescope, which up until recently was the largest radio telescope in the world, it's been surpassed by one in China now. But for a long time, it was one of the premier places to do SETI work. And indeed, astronomers have spent a lot of time using that telescope to look at different stars and listen for signals. Back in 1974, after a project to upgrade the telescope, there was a little ceremony, and Frank Drake, who was the director of Arecibo at the time, arranged for the transmission of a short message. The Arecibo message has wound up becoming the most famous example of METI, or messaging extraterrestrial intelligence. And it consisted of basically a sort of simplified graphic It was, the signal itself was a series of just bits, basically almost, you can almost think of it like Morse code, on or off. But there were exactly 1,679 of these bits. And that, if you're a mathematician at all, and you received 1,679 bits, you might you'd factor it very quickly and realize that that was, that's got two prime factors, 23 and 73. And if you arrange the bits in a grid that's 23 rows across and 73 columns high, you would wind up with a picture. And that picture was designed to convey a whole bunch of information about us and our level of scientific understanding and where our solar system is and what we're made of and that kind of thing. It was a stunt. I don't think it was ever intended to be received by anyone. In fact, it was pointed in a direction where no one will ever receive it. But it was a way of showing that this, you know, if you have these powerful telescopes that can receive very faint signals, then by definition, they're also capable of transmitting very powerful signals. And in fact, the Arecibo message was sent out at such a high power that any Arecibo-sized telescope anywhere in the galaxy would be capable of receiving it. So, you know, in principle, we know we can do this. Whether we should do it is a totally different question, and we haven't done a ton of it, partly for that reason, you know, I don't think scientists, let alone average citizens, have really thought through all of the pluses and minuses to the idea of giving away our location. Of course, there are other folks who argue that we've been doing exactly that since the 30s. You know, we haven't been very careful about all of the radio and TV signals leaking out into space. So anyone who was listening at those frequencies would already know that we're here.
What is the Goldilocks zone?
Right. Well, when you're thinking about how common life might be in the galaxy, one important question is how many habitable planets might there be where life could get started? And around every star, there is sort of a region. You can think of it as a sort of a perimeter or a zone where if a planet was orbiting inside that zone, then it wouldn't be so cold that liquid water would freeze and become unusable by life. And it wouldn't be so close that liquid water would boil off. It would be in that nice zone where water would stay liquid. And there may be some sort of terracentricity, so to speak, in this whole idea. But we do think that water is probably an essential ingredient for life, or at least it's a lot harder to imagine how life could get started in any other medium. But the Goldilocks zone is basically that place where it's not too cold, not too hot, and it's just right for water to stay liquid and potentially become the breeding ground for organic molecules that, you know, form into self-replicating molecules that form into life that start the whole chain of evolution.
Starting in about the 1980s, we began discovering the idea of exoplanets, and it's just burgeoned into more than a cottage industry. It's an industry. What are exoplanets, and how does the Goldilocks zone vary with stellar type?
Right. An exoplanet is shorthand for extrasolar planet, and it just means any planet that's verified to exist around some star other than our sun. And we had no evidence that there were any exoplanets at all until the mid-90s. But since then, we've developed a couple of different techniques for spotting them indirectly. And now we know that there are at least 4,000 for sure. And the number's growing all the time. The way you detect exoplanets, by the way, is either by measuring the wobble of the star that this planet orbits around, because you know, if the planet's large enough, it would kind of cause a detectable motion as the planet and the sun kind of mutually orbit around their center of gravity. You can actually measure that variation as the star moves across your field of view. The other way we find exoplanets is when they happen to cross in front of their suns, and that causes a minute but detectable decrease in the luminosity of that star. And if the period fits a certain curve, you can conclude pretty confidently that was a planet that passed in front of it. So we've now found about 4,000 and growing of those cases in the galaxy. And it turns out that a lot of these exoplanets are around stars that are very unlike our star. Our sun is an average G-type star that is going to be relatively long-lived, long enough for life to have started here in our solar system, obviously. But turns out there are a lot of exoplanets around red dwarfs, which are much smaller and much cooler, but live way longer than our G-type star. So you can imagine a red dwarf that's tens of billions of years old, which actually creates a pretty long runway for life to get started in those kinds of solar systems. So when we find exoplanets around those kinds of stars, obviously the Goldilocks zone for those kinds of solar systems is going to be much closer in to the star than it would be in our solar system. So you can imagine, and in fact, we have discovered solar systems where, like, there are multiple planets, but they're all orbiting inside what we would think of as sort of the orbit of Mercury. Can just imagine like a miniature solar system where every planet is so close to its star that its radius of orbit is smaller than the orbit of Mercury. And that can kind of like give you a picture of the weirdness of a lot of other solar systems.
Well, I know we've discovered a number of planets which are definitely in the habitable zone. But getting on to something that you discussed, what is the Great Silence and what are some possible explanations for it?
The Great Silence it's basically the premise that Fermi was starting with at that lunchtime conversation at Los Alamos. I mean, he was discounting the possibility that flying saucers really represented aliens. And he was saying, well, look, it looks like nobody's visited us. And not only that, but we haven't heard from anyone else. And that continues to be the case. We couldn't test that idea in 1950, but starting around 1960, we did start testing that idea. And SETI's been going on for 60 years. And we have found no repeated credible evidence of radio or optical signals from other stars. So that is the Great Silence. It's just the fact that we seem to be alone. And what was the other half of your question, Jim?
What are some possible explanations for the Great Silence?
Oh, okay. Well, that's what the bulk of my book is about.
Exactly. And now we're there.
Yeah. So there are a lot of different explanations
expound
for the Great
away.
Silence. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's actually a book out there that catalogs 75 solutions to the Fermi paradox or to the Great Silence, and it's by a wonderful writer named Stephen Webb, W-E-B-B, and readers who are really hungry for a deep dive on every conceivable explanation that's ever been proposed can go and find that book. I don't try to go through all of them in such extreme detail in my book, but I do try to boil them down into general categories. And I would say one category of answers basically boils down to we're alone. The reason we don't see any signals out there is because we are the only advanced civilization. We're the only intelligent beings who have the technology to listen or communicate. And that might mean that we're the first. It might mean that we're the last. But in any case, it means we're alone. And the reason we don't see anyone else is because they aren't there. And there have been some very credible and compelling arguments for the uniqueness of life on Earth. There was a book called Rare Earth that came out in 2000 that made a very sort of exhaustive list of reasons why Earth is unusual and why if you kind of tweaked any specific thing about our local environment, it might have made life impossible here on Earth. Like, for example, the fact that we have a magnetic field. Our planet has a very strong magnetic field, which winds up sparing us from the worst of ultraviolet radiation and cosmic rays and a whole bunch of other nasty stuff from outside. We have a moon, which is relatively large and relatively close, and it helps to stabilize the tilt of our axis. And it's arguable that without the moon, the Earth's axis would precess much more wildly than it actually has. And you can imagine a planet where it's spending half of its time kind of tipped on its side and different regions of the planet aren't getting equal exposure to the sun would be a very hard place for life to start. I could go on and on. We have a giant neighbor in our solar system in the form of Jupiter. And there are ideas that Jupiter's presence helps to sweep away a lot of the space debris that would otherwise be raining down on the Earth and destroying life here. So the rare earth hypothesis is, in fact, boils down to the idea that earth-like places are so rare that we shouldn't really expect to see them anywhere else. That's an extreme sort of pessimistic, I would say, or maybe realistic. It depends on how you're feeling. On the opposite end of the scale, there are explanations that assume that we're not alone and that there must be some reason why we haven't been able to make contact with other civilizations. And I'm obviously skipping over a whole bunch of possibilities here, but I'm just going to, you know, like zoom to the way other end of the spectrum and talk about those kinds of explanations. If you conclude from your reading of the Drake equation that there must be thousands or millions or billions of other civilizations in our galaxy, then you have to start asking yourself, okay, why haven't they contacted us, or why can't we detect any signs of their existence? And that has led to speculation about ideas such as the zoo hypothesis, also called the quarantine hypothesis, which is the idea that, aliens are out there and they know we're here and they're deliberately concealing themselves or keeping their existence secret until the moment when they feel like it's safe to admit us into their club. And it's a very science fiction idea, but who knows? I mean, I guess it's plausible. I'm not sure I would want humanity in its current state to be part of the galactic civilization. I'm not sure we've quite grown up to that point. But, that's an opinion at the far other end of the spectrum. And there are lots of others, possible explanations in between. And I really, rather than go through them one at a time, I would really recommend that folks get the book and read chapter 4.
Absolutely. But there are a couple of things that I would like to definitely discuss. Sure. And these are your particular ideas, because after all, you wrote this book, and having read it and having said that, I want to say that I enjoyed it immensely. And I recommend it for basically anybody who likes thinking about these problems. And if you don't like thinking about these problems, why are you listening to this particular podcast? But one of the ideas that you have is something called the wrong glass. And that seems sort of central to your way of thinking. And I'd like you to expound a little on it.
I'd be happy to. So in order to explain what I mean by wrong glass, I have to refer back to a couple of other stories. So I've been talking about pessimistic and optimistic ways to interpret the great silence. And that leads you to the glass half empty, glass half full metaphor. At the same time, there's a very famous SETI scientist and astronomer named Jill Tarter, who's been one of the leading proponents of SETI and one of the innovators who's kind of kept the whole SETI enterprise going over the years. And in her writing and her speeches, including a TED Talk she gave back in 2009, I think, she has often compared our progress on SETI so far to dipping a single glass into the ocean and coming up with a glass full of water. And so you ask yourself, did you find a fish in that glass? Well, if you didn't find a fish, you could conclude that there are no fish, or you could conclude that we've only begun to sample and we need to go much farther before we can really draw any conclusions. So what I'm trying to say with the wrong glass idea is, I'm trying to get beyond these glass half empty or glass half full approaches, and I'm even trying to get beyond the kind of traditional SETI outlook, which is that we might need to keep searching for decades or centuries in order to have a really good chance of finding a signal. And I'm trying to get people to think about the possibility that maybe a glass isn't the right tool for finding fish. Maybe the fish know that we are looking for them and they're scurrying out of the way. Maybe fish aren't even what we should be looking for, right? So maybe we're using the wrong glass. That's a key concept that I kind of want to leave people with, because I think we've been doing traditional SETI for long enough that certainly we should not slow down or stop, but we should also start thinking about whether we might want to reconceive this whole enterprise and start thinking about what other types of life might exist that we haven't conceived of yet. And if we stretch our imaginations a little bit and try to think of life as we do not know it, to quote another SETI astronomer named Natalie Cabral, then we might be able to come up with search modalities or types of media, types of communication schemes, types of languages, types of signals that we would never have conceived of before, and that once we start thinking more broadly, we might eventually discover that there have been signals there all along, and we just weren't listening to them correctly. So that's sort of the wrong glass idea broadly.
Well, you know, one of the things that I won't say it bothers me, but when I read this, I said, okay, that's a good possibility, but could you outline some of the ways that we may be completely missing this? Because I mean, I'm a scientist, or at least I like to think of mathematics as a science, and the glass analogy struck me as very reasonable when I read that Jill Tarter, who one of the things your book told me was, I didn't realize this, but Jill Tarter was the model for the heroine of Carl Sagan's novel Contact. I didn't realize that at the time, but. I think of this as, well, what would such a communication be? I mean, this is about the time you start thinking about, well, other ways, mysterious Zen ways or philosophical way. But I can't get, you know, I can't wrap my head around these. And so I sort of hope that you would illustrate with a couple of ways that we might think of it in a totally different fashion.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to say first off that I'm not a physicist, and I'd like to beg forgiveness in advance for any goofs or misinterpretations that I'm about to offer. But one analogy or one similar situation you can look to is a situation in astronomy around gravity waves, right? So general relativity from 1915 predicted that space was distorted by mass, and that there ought to be situations where if something big enough happened, if two giant masses collided, there would be detectable ripples in the space-time fabric that was first sort of theorized by Einstein. For, you know, upwards of 80 or 90 years, we didn't have any way to test that. Gravitational waves were a purely theoretical idea. And while most physicists agreed they probably did exist because they were predicted by theory, we didn't have any way to measure that. And it wasn't until the last decade that we actually perfected instruments that allowed us to start measuring tiny ripples in space caused by things like very distant black hole collisions. And now we know, and now there have been, in the last 5 years, there have been I think on the order of dozens or scores of observations of these giant gravitational events elsewhere in the universe. And we are now officially gravitational wave astronomers. In addition to being optical astronomers and radio wave astronomers and X-ray wave astronomers, we can now do gravitational wave astronomy, something that was completely theoretical up until the last decade. That's a kind of analogy for the situation that I'm talking about. I'm not proposing that there's anything Zen or supernatural going on. I'm not proposing that we just need to like get centered and tap into some cosmic meditation in order to find other aliens. What I'm proposing is that our science is not complete, that physics has holes, that there are things we don't understand. What is dark energy? What is dark matter? Why is the expansion of the universe accelerating? What are superstrings, right? How are quantum mechanics and general relativity both possible, and how can we reconcile the two of them? So there are all sorts of big questions that we haven't figured out yet. It's conceivable that as we start to figure some of those things out, we'll stumble across additional ways of communicating, additional media that could be used for communication. And I went to a really fascinating little talk at Harvard a couple of years ago where an astronomer was proposing that if a very powerful technological civilization wanted to create an obvious, unmistakable beacon of its existence, what they would do would be to create an artificial black hole about the mass of Jupiter and put it into orbit around Sagittarius A star, which is the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. And that confluence of a small black hole orbiting a giant black hole would create gravity waves that you could detect anywhere in the galaxy, assuming you had a gravity wave detector, and that if that small black hole stayed in a stable orbit for more than a year or two, you would know for sure that it wasn't a natural thing, that it was artificial, because the only way to keep it in that stable orbit would be to apply a continuous sort of thrust to keep it from falling into the larger black hole. That was like a totally whimsical example, but a provocative example of how you can imagine using a gravity, how you can imagine sort of constructing a gravity wave-based signal or communication of a sort. So let's just try and keep stretching our imaginations in that way. Maybe we haven't discovered everything about, you know, how to transmit information using quantum entangled particles, for example. I'm not going to go any farther than that because I don't know enough of the physics. I'm just saying, let's keep our minds open to the possibility that the radio and optical spectra are not the only places to look for signals.
I think you're probably right about that, but it seems to me that it requires a much more advanced technological civilization. And I like the idea that Carl Sagan propounded in, I think it was in Contact, where you just send out a radio signal consisting of prime numbers. Everybody knows that that's going to be artificial. And it's something that it's easily achievable as soon as you develop radio, which I think is a lot sooner than a civilization coming up with ways to manipulate quantum entangled particles or gravitation. But that's just me.
Well, I like that scenario too. I think the reason I'm more suspicious about it now than I would have been, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago when Sagan was writing Contact and when they were making a movie out of it, is that it's suspiciously anthropocentric, right? It depends on a chain of events that really strikingly resemble exactly what happened here on Earth.
It's us. And
it's us. Right. We're looking for us. Well, the extraterrestrials might not look like us, and they might not think like us. That's all I'm really saying.
Yeah. Wade, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. And I'd like to I always end interviews by asking, first of all, how can a listener get in touch with you?
Oh, well, they can find out more about the book at the MIT Press website at mitpress.edu. They can search for extraterrestrials on Amazon. My personal website is at waderausch.com. That's Wade, R-O-U-S-H.com. I make my own podcast about technology in the future. It's called Soonish, and people can find that at soonishpodcast.org. And both my website and the Soonish website have contact forms where people can email me.
Terrific. And do you have any future projects we might be interested in? Namely, books I can podcast with you.
Absolutely. And I'll let you know as soon as I can actually talk about them publicly.
Wonderful. Wade, it's been a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you, Jim. This has been a pleasure. Thanks so much.